Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello and welcome to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. This is Brian Strauser, Principal and CEO at BrightPath. And with me today is...
Hi there, this is Jen Otremba, Senior Consultant at BrightPath.
Hi, this is Bray Wheeler, Consultant at BrightPath.
And this is our Brightcast kind of news episode for the week of July 1st, 2019. We're recording this on the morning of July 1st, though you won't hear it until a bit later this week. So what do we got to start off with on our kind of three major events for the week?
So this morning we're going to kick it off kind of unfortunately with some aviation events that happened kind of bookending the weekend here. On Friday here locally in Minnesota, a helicopter, a medevac helicopter crashed early in the morning on Friday in the Brainerd area of Minnesota, which is about 2 hours north of the Twin Cities. In that crash, both the pilots and the medevac nurse were killed. The medic on board sustained injuries is expected to make a full recovery, but that occurred over the weekend. Fortunately, no patients were on board, but there was foggy weather. It was late in the morning. Jen, you have expertise on that one. Here is kind of the expert. But then the other incident that happened over the weekend was a plane crash in Dallas that killed all 10 on board. It sounded like it occurred on takeoff, veered into a hangar, and then unfortunately that caused the loss of life. So I think really where our focus is this morning is just on that aviation safety. Companies having a plan, even if it's just you're a small company and you travel via commercial flight, but you know those things are real and they're happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, I mean, this is heartbreaking for the aviation community, specifically rotary wing, because this really hits close to home here since it was one of our own here, North Memorial. And we don't know the cause of either of these accidents. And generally, we won't know until it could be a year from now before mm-hmm. accident investigations come out. But so it's absolutely heartbreaking. And I always think of, well, I wonder what happened. What would I have done? For those that don't know, I'm also a helicopter pilot for the Army National Guard. And I always think what happened, what the pilot could have done or couldn't have done, or what they were going through, especially in those last moments before the crash. Like Bray said, in that particular instance, I know that the weather was really bad and it was early in the morning, and all of those things kind of lead to, in my mind, a potentially bad situation. So really, really heartbreaking for everyone involved with that. And the Dallas incident, of course, that's not as local for us, but also obviously very heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And as Bray said, the biggest thing for us here at BrightPath is what kind of plans are in place for these companies that own these aircraft and what that looks like now moving forward and what it looked like beforehand.
There were a couple things that came to mind for me about the North Memorial crash, the medical transport helicopter that crashed here in Minnesota, is that North Memorial had a previous crash, fortunately not fatal, 3 years ago in Alexandria, Minnesota. The pilot and the paramedic, and I believe there was a nurse on board, all survived. The medic, though, in particular, had significant injuries and is... I think he considers himself very lucky to have survived the accident. And I think that came back as pilot error in the NTSB investigation, but it'll be months before we know anything about what happened in the North Memorial or Brainerd accident that occurred. The other thing that came to mind, and this applies to both, is just, you know, the three of us have been in roles where we've had some responsibility for aviation response in the private sector, and we had to write some pretty extensive plans around, you know, how we would respond to an aviation incident because our previous employer owned and operated and leased aircraft, sometimes with our own pilots and sometimes with contracted pilots or a contracted service to do that. But we still own responsibility for that. And I think we've seen... As consultants, we've seen companies with a lack of aviation planning or have some really poor plans. So maybe we talk just briefly about what we're really looking for here when we talk about aviation planning for a company.
Well, I think it's even one of those things where depending on the size of the company and what kind of flight operations you have, because, you know, even smaller companies, we have a client that's not giant, but they still have, you know, pretty extensive kind of air travel capabilities within their company. I think it's really about, no matter the size of that, it's really having something in place or using kind of existing plans you have in place for loss of life, for a tragic situation. You know, how are you communicating with families? How are you communicating with employees? Things like that are already in place. And then you just kind of add on, kind of depending on what the size of your company is and what your capabilities are, what other plans do you need to put into place around decision-making and notification and just being able to kind of manage through it.
Yeah, family support is a big part of this, particularly if you're operating your own aircraft. I think having a process in place to be able to notify family members of your employees or others that were on board the aircraft that there had been an incident and that they had, you know, that there were injuries or fatalities that occurred, I think is a critically important part of the plan, and understanding how you're going to maintain contact and support the family members through this. I think there's a reputational aspect too. And I thought about this with the North Memorial incident, just being the second crash that they'd had. And certainly there's going to be an investigation, and that investigation will take time to get to an answer. But the questions from the press are not going to stop.
And they're not going to wait for an answer that's clear cut either.
Like, why did this happen a second time? Mm-hmm. So anything else on?
I guess I would go one step further in, aside from having plans for our own or leased aircraft, we also have some experience with travel monitoring. So even if they're flying a commercial aircraft or another
aircraft.
Yep. Right. We have all experienced specifically around executive monitoring and knowing where they're flying to and where they're going. So we always knew where they were at. So if something were to happen, we could keep track of that as well.
Well, I think, you mean, to your point, just having awareness to where your employees are going.
Absolutely.
So that you're not just running your day-to-day operations and all of a sudden there's a crash and it's like, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
We had two employees on that plane.
Right.
And you're not reacting in real time to the knowledge that you're supposed to have and be able to make those decisions and jump on it early. You know, I mean, reputation aside, just doing right by the employees and their families.
Exactly.
And having that available.
Yeah, there's just a whole circle of communication around, you know, having things happen to your employees, not only the communication to the family, which needs to be the paramount thing that happens, but there's also communication to coworkers and to perhaps to the company writ large, because if you don't tell that story the way you want the story told, or the way that your employee wants the story told, they're going to get it from the press and, or they're going to get it from the rumor mill. And neither of those is a good look for your organization when you're in a crisis. It needs to come from leadership. And be communicated that way.
Right.
So the second item of news that we're touching on today actually started early this morning, and that is more protests and disruption in Hong Kong over the extradition bill that has been under consideration there now for several weeks. You know, we didn't plan it this way, but today, July 1st, we released our podcast episode on what was going on in Hong Kong, and it's already out of date because of events that occurred early this morning. But the protesters, and I saw numbers, 500,000 to 600,000, is that? Yeah. So up to 600,000 protesters, but they've gone a little farther this time. They have surrounded the legislative building. This is where Hong Kong's legislature meets. They got inside the building. They took over the legislative chamber. The last update we saw is that they were standing on top of lawmakers' desks and they were spray painting symbols and art inside the hall, and that's where things stand as of about 30 minutes ago. So it's quite a scene. I mean, there's no way that law enforcement, even modern law enforcement in Hong Kong, can contain 600,000 people.
Yeah, I was going to say, first of all,
I mean, we can do that
just
here in the
US. Think of that amount of people, 500,000 to 600,000 people. I mean, what does that even look like? What does that look like? That is unbelievable.
Right.
Well, I would actually argue that they probably weren't as prepared as they probably should have been for this one.
No.
Because what's unique about this kind of protest today, too, is it's July 1st, which is the anniversary of the transition from Britain to China.
Oh, you're right.
Yes.
And so typically there's always peaceful protests that are going on. And for the most part, it sounds like these continue to be peaceful. But with all of the protests over the last couple of weeks, probably should have been a little bit more prepared or amped up to know, because it's pretty predictable in terms of what they're doing. The size is pretty unique. I think there was a graphic somebody had, you know, that had different estimates from, you know, whether you're an organizer or government official or kind of media on site. There's only been a couple other instances where the numbers have reached kind of somewhere in this realm. Otherwise, they've been pretty smaller, but they happen every year. But it's probably one of those things where certain locations, certainly Parliament, probably should have been a little bit more isolated than it was.
I think, too, thinking of some of the different organizations that we've worked with throughout the years and what that looks like when protesters get into the building, and what, how do you manage through that once they're already in the building? I know for us, it's always better to keep them, make sure security is doing their job and keeping the protesters peacefully outside of the premises of the building. But what happens when they get into that building, and how do you peacefully remove them from the building, and what that can look like? Because that can go south very, very quickly, as we've seen in the past too.
So I think the protesters are demanding the resignation of Hong Kong's chief executive, right?
Carrie Lam.
They're demanding her resignation. She's been in office for some time, and she spent her whole career in the Hong Kong civil service. But no one arises to be the chief executive of Hong Kong without the blessing of China. So clearly she has China's support, at least going into the position. I'm not sure how confident they're feeling in her leadership at this point. It's hard to say. That's a black box in terms of what we know.
She was at least an acceptable choice
at the time. Yeah, I'm really kind of curious where that goes. So the questions here for business are kind of the same as what we talk about in our long form podcast today, which is, if you're in Hong Kong or you travel through Hong Kong and you're not monitoring what's going on, you're behind. There's a pretty significant set of disruption going on there, and I don't see it going away. And no. The Chinese government response is going to be the fascinating part of this, because they've really not meddled in Hong Kong in this way before. I mean, we talked a little bit about that before, that, you know, kind of pushing this kind of legislation is a new move for them, but they've never meddled in Hong Kong in terms of using force.
Correct. Yeah, I think it's one of those things where this is starting to probably become a little bit more real. And certainly this is, we're saying that in the context of the current kind of situation, and who knows, this might calm down in a couple of months and kind of resolve itself a little bit. But I think there is that simmering tension, and especially with kind of broader relationship discussions between the international community and China and democracy at large, and kind of where that's going kind of globally. I think there, this is, the protesters are making a stand, and they're kind of using timing of both the legislation and the anniversary of the date to kind of really gain some momentum and kind of push the issue and push it more international than just kind of the local. They're protesting again. It's July 1st. It's a little bit more this time.
Seems to be fairly effective so far, I think.
They seem to be getting their point across.
Yeah.
Definitely have gotten their point across.
Yeah. Now, what happens with that is going to be the interesting part.
I suspect we'll see developments later this week.
It'll be interesting to see how the international community responds back into this too. They've been relatively quiet.
Yeah, when do they start
in the conversation? When do they start speaking out? When do they start kind of pushing some different narratives that kind of hold China back, or perhaps even embolden China with what they're doing? I think it's just a matter of the time and see where that angle takes the conversation.
I think we'll be talking about this again next week.
No doubt. Yeah, so it appears that it was a smaller group that came into the Legislative Assembly building, but they broke a glass of doors, removed metal bars, defaced portraits of previous chief executives and presidents of the chamber. So, interesting. Let's move on to our last story of the day.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So the last story of the day, just wanted to bring this up because last week some additional news kind of has come out about a university student in Utah who was involved with her ex-boyfriend who had killed her and himself. And why this is extremely tragic and a big deal. The biggest part of the news lately is that the parents have come out and sued the university. Now, in the past, many of these things have come out. There's been reputational issues. There's some demands for if a student, something happened to a student, that the school would take some kind of responsibility for that. But it's becoming more and more common that there, that responsibility is turning into a monetary responsibility for universities, for businesses, for corporations, for states to have some major responsibility here with these violent cases. And so I think the latest I saw was this parents were suing the school for $56 million dollar lawsuit against the school.
The thing that stood out to me, I didn't read the lawsuit, but the news coverage surrounding the lawsuit, she had reported to the university police multiple times about this guy's threatening actions. Like, was it like 20-some times?
Yeah, allegedly. That I've seen a few different reports as to what they're saying, but allegedly there has been several reports prior to the incident occurring itself where she has brought forth some concerning behavior, leakage, we call it, in workplace violence.
There's always leakage.
There's always leakage of very threatening behavior, controlling behavior, possessive behavior, manipulative, very, very concerning behavior that definitely pointed towards some kind of violent behavior that would come out of this. And unfortunately, I don't know specifics around what the school had done or what actions the school had done, but the parents feel that wasn't enough, clearly. And we'll see, I guess, where this one goes. You know,
I mean, from having read the news coverage, I don't think the university did much at all around this.
It does not sound like it.
But of course, we're getting one side of the story. The university will certainly have its chance to, in court or elsewhere, to explain the case. Suspect this never gets to trial.
Yeah. They're saying no investigation at all occurred, no plans developed or implemented for her sake or her safety or those around her either, which is also concerning.
I'm a little flabbergasted by this one. If we take the parent's story at face value, and I'm not saying that that is the 100% of the facts here, but universities have pretty clear regulatory and legal requirements to take action when there is a credible threat, to communicate to the broader campus community. And here I'm speaking about the requirements under the Clery Act, where they have to send this kind of communication, either an imminent, I forget the specific term, but there's like the imminent notice, emergency notification that has to go out if there's a credible threat. And then there's a duty to warn requirement that can be done in a less serious situation, but it doesn't appear that either of those were done. Of course, we don't know for sure what was communicated.
I mean, there's also the general duty clause under OSHA as
OSHA
well.
Guidelines,
so
right.
Even if those other things didn't exist, there's OSHA is always going to be in existence there with that.
Right. I mean, I was chief security officer for a university system that operated throughout North America and in several states, and the requirement around our internal requirements around this would have dictated that action be taken and an investigation be conducted and a, if appropriate, mitigation plan be put into place to ensure her safety and the safety of those around her. And I think that's kind of the lesson here for a business or a university is you have to take this stuff seriously. You need to believe the alleged victim here in this case and take action.
Is it enough to do just a threat assessment?
Well, I think it's all going to be dependent on what the facts are that come out of any kind of investigation. But from what I can see, at least what the initial reporting is, that there was no investigation conducted at all. So in the event of nothing, I mean, I can't tell you if it's going to be enough because we don't know what would come out in that investigation. I think you were doing, Bray, a little bit further digging, and didn't you find some concerning information when she found out when they were dating and she found out he was actually lying to her about some pretty significant things?
Yeah. Well, according to a couple of the reports, really kind of what precipitated kind of the fallout between the two of them was she allegedly broke up with him in October of last year after she found out that he had lied about his name, his age, and his status as a sex offender. So it turns out he's, according to some of these reports, he's actually 37. And she was 21 at the time that she was killed. So it's a pretty big That's a pretty big age gap.
Now, I didn't see. Was he a student with her?
That I didn't see.
I haven't seen that anywhere
either.
I don't
believe so.
And that could be why the university chose to not do any further action, because if he wasn't a student there, they might have been limited what they could have done, but they could have done some information sharing with local law enforcement as well. So there's always something that can be done, but they may have not taken the action that the parents felt that they should have because he wasn't, in fact, a student there. If that is the case, mm-hmm. I don't know.
My understanding is that the university had a university police department. So mm-hmm. I think they probably had more jurisdiction than we would typically see.
Sure.
Right. I mean, every states treat this differently. Right. Here in Minnesota, private schools don't have law enforcement, and really only the University of Minnesota has campus police. But in Massachusetts, where I lived for a decade, everybody's got cops.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Private, public, everyone's got their own department. And I think this was Utah.
Yes.
Correct? Utah.
Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like not only did she go to university police, she also went to
local
housing. The university housing.
And said, yeah. Sure. Interesting.
You know, I have this going on.
I don't feel safe here in the dorm.
Yep.
Right.
Or housing unit.
Certainly, regardless of the investigation, there could have been some actions put in place to help her and those around her feel safe with some safety planning mm-hmm. for her or classrooms that she is going in and out of and the housing area that she's living in. There certainly could have been some safety precautions taken. I don't know if those were taken or not, or if they met. They obviously didn't meet the standard of what the parents were expecting.
Right.
I don't know beyond that what was done, but I think, like you said, Brian, this is definitely a lesson for mm-hmm. all organizations to really take these things seriously and understand, you know, even if the university police didn't help, there are other information sharing jurisdictions out there that could probably step in and kind of keep owning your safety, you mm-hmm. know, keep pushing that till you get the help that you need as well.
I mean, I feel like this is something we always keep coming back to, and that is the in the moment making the right decision. That when this threat was brought up and her safety concerns were brought up, we should believe her in the things that she's saying pending investigation, and we should take the right action. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Leslie Muniz situation at CBS, where people came forward and credibly accused him of all kinds of sexual harassment and some violent-ish behavior, and the board in the first accusation, the board of CBS just brush it off. They don't conduct a thorough investigation. They kind of half-ass it. And then when more allegations came out, they hired a different law firm to investigate it. And lo and behold, 25 years of crap comes out about the guy, right? So again, it's about, I think from a leadership standpoint, it's about making the right decision in the moment when it's happening. And that doesn't appear to have happened here, but we'll find out.
Well, I think to that point, your earlier point too, it's not just about the victim or the accuser or the student herself. It's about the university. It's about those other students in the classroom. It's about the campus at large in these situations, that it's not just
the other residents person. Of the housing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's everybody else around her. And if, you know, you're getting accusations like some of these things and you don't know what people's capabilities are, if you're not taking it seriously up front, you're exposing everybody to it instead of keeping it under control and mitigating it as much as you can.
Especially what sounds like here is a very highly volatile situation. I mean, I was just reading through some of what things were being reported. So multiple concerning reports of stalking, physical abuse, emotional abuse, intimidation, dating violence, domestic violence, sexual harassment, gender-based discrimination, and other abusive behaviors. So this isn't a one-time he's being mean to me kind of situation. Mm-hmm. These were repeated.
Yeah, like what was going on at the university that they didn't act? I know we don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It is really hard to say.
So the lesson here is take action. When these issues come up, and don't walk away from it until you've investigated what's really going on.
Yeah.
With that. That's it for this episode of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. Tune in later this week for a deep dive roundtable discussion between the three of us on crisis leadership. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe through your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.